Good morning, everyone. I'm so delighted to see you here this morning. Thank you so much for getting up early and coming in. And I do want to note for whoever is maybe doesn't realize that the legislature, the House, was in session last night until 3:15 in the morning. And so even though I know that a lot of members are very interested in the topic that we're going to hear about today, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't get more because, you know, circumstances being what they are at the end of session. But we didn't want to miss the opportunity to hear from the Department of Health on this very important topic, and I know that those of us who are here are very excited about it, and those who are not here are also excited about it, and I'm sure will learn more when they have the opportunity. So with that, I would welcome Dr. Ellinger to come to the table. And I think, members, as we go through this, as I understand it, the presentation is kind of in three parts. Is that correct, Dr. Ellinger? And then
I will be presenting, and Melanie Peterson-Hickey will also be presenting, and then we'll be available for questions.
Okay, I'm just thinking, how should we handle questions if there are any? Do you
certainly
want us to
as
wait?
As we move along, I'd be open.
Just as we move along. Okay, very good. Thank you. So welcome to the committee, Dr. Ellinger, and please go ahead and introduce yourself and give
Madam
us your
Chair,
presentation.
Members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health, and as you mentioned, we're at the end of the session, but I'm looking at this presentation as not just a presentation at one of the last hearings of the session, but actually this is, I think, the hearing for the next session. It's the because our work to advance health equity is really never done. It's a continuing process, and I'm thinking that this is a good way to launch some of the continued activities during the summer and next fall and into the next session. And so I'm here, and I'll give you a little background of how we came to our Advancing Health Equity Report and give you a little context of how that moves forward. You know, as you're well aware, Minnesota is really a healthy state. We are, by United Health Foundation's rankings, we're the third healthiest state in the country. We have the latest statistics for 2010, we have the lowest infant mortality rate in the country. We have just had a report for the second year in a row. We have the number one senior health status in the country. We have the longest life expectancy for males and the second longest life expectancy for females in the country. And a recent report just came out 2 weeks ago. We are number one in health care for access, quality, cost, and outcomes. And so we're a really healthy state. And why is that? I think it's because people who've come before us, our parents, our grandparents, and our great-grandparents, really made investments in what creates health, investments in the policy decisions that were made, investments in resources. They've invested in education. They've invested in our environment. They've invested in economic development. They've invested in our communities. And they've actually invested in our healthcare system, which, compared to many other states, focuses a lot more on population perspectives and prevention than others. You know, we've had some investments, and so we're benefiting from the investments in a whole variety of areas that were made many, many years ago. And so my job as health commissioner is to sort of pay that forward, to make sure that my children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and yours benefit in the same way that we're benefiting from those previous investments. But as somebody who's worked in this state now for 34 years and who's been health commissioner for 3.5 years, I see that there are some issues that are going to make staying that healthy in terms of our national ranking quite difficult, because we have an increasing number of disparities in our country, in our state, with people who are not sharing in all the benefits that everybody is. In fact, we have some of the greatest disparities in the country. We have the greatest disparity in black-white infant mortality in the country. Even though our overall infant mortality is the best, our disparity is the worst. We have disparities in teen pregnancy rates. We have disparities in length of healthy life after the age of 65, so that actually the African Americans, the length of unhealthy life is twice that of the white population. So after the age of 65, the medical care is great, but the things that really create health, the public health, the prevention activities are not as good. And if you name almost any condition, And there are people in the room here from various other disciplines that if you look at the diseases or conditions, there are disparities in almost every one of those. And then we have all of those other things that really help to create health. Where we also have disparities. We have the lowest home ownership rate among African Americans in the country in Minnesota. Lowest per capita income among African Americans. Poverty rates, incarceration rates, high school graduation rates. All of those things that predict health have some huge disparities within our state. And this is important because when I moved to the state in 1980, populations of color and American Indians made up about 3% of our population. Today, they're about 18% of our population. And if you look at kindergartners, second graders throughout the state, 34% of all second graders are kids of color and American Indians. So that means that we are going to become an increasingly diverse state. And unless we deal with the disparities that are in our state, we're not going to be able to maintain the health status that we've got. You know, I always say it's a math problem. In addition to being a disparities problem, it's a math problem. Given the changing population, if we don't deal with the disparities, we're going to have a problem maintaining our overall healthy population. For me, as health commissioner, I see eliminating health disparities, I see advancing health equity as the primary challenge that we have. And I really believe, as a state, that is one of our primary challenges and should be one of our greatest should be our priority to eliminate disparities, particularly eliminating health disparities. So, to address that, when I became commissioner, we continued the Healthy Minnesota Partnership, which is a group of folks from throughout the state, from multiple disciplines, not just from the healthcare field, but from education and from business and from housing and transportation, in the public and private sector, to look at what we needed to do to really be a healthy state, how we should move forward, what kind of framework would we have. And we came at this discussion with a broad definition of health. We use the definition that the World Health Organization has, that health is just not is a state of complete physical, social, and mental well-being. It's not just the absence of disease or disability. So having a much more comprehensive view. And we also looked at the fact that health is a resource. It's not an end in itself. It's actually a resource for people. It's to really use their abilities in in the social and economic and personal context to really advance the health of the entire state, of their individuals and their families. So it is not health is not the end in itself, but it is a resource for moving forward. And you have before you two charts. On this little, and I was cautioned by my staff that we should have them in bigger, but I overwrote them, and I think they were right, so they might be a little hard to read. But those are two charts that really form the basis of the Healthy Minnesota 2020 work. The chart on the bottom, I think, is really instructive as we look at moving forward with health, because it says what creates health. And most people think that health is created by our medical care system, and by individuals making choices about physical activity and nutrition and smoking. If you look at it, medical care really only accounts for about 10% of our overall health. And personal behaviors, account for about 30% of our health. The biggest part are the socioeconomic factors. About 40% of our health is really dictated by socioeconomic factors. And those are things that are influenced really by policies and systems and our environment. And if you look closely at those behaviors, many of those behaviors that people choose are influenced by where they live and by the choices that are offered to them. So it's difficult for people to make good choices about eating right or exercising if they live in a community or a situation where they don't have access to good food, or they don't have the income to really purchase good food, or they don't live in a safe neighborhood where they can do a lot of exercising, or they don't have good schools in their community. So that really, I think, those socioeconomic factors are the big piece of what we really need to do if we're going to be a healthy state. And so with that background, our Healthy Minnesota Partnership, knowing what creates health, put together the chart that's on the top, which really was the themes that they wanted. The vision is to have all people in Minnesota enjoy healthy lives and healthy communities on the far right. But they recognized that there, to do that, we needed three things. One, we needed healthy children. That's the, on the far left, those themes. We need, you know, all children should have the opportunity to be healthy. We needed healthy communities, and we needed to eliminate disparities, that everybody needed to be healthy in all parts of our state. And so they recognized that we needed to really focus on kids, we needed to focus on communities, and that we needed to focus on eliminating disparities throughout the state. And you can see that the approach that they take, that they took in developing the indicators, the next set of factors there, was that the factors, the indicators, the way we're going to measure our success, many of those, in fact, most of those, are not medical care related. Yes, prenatal care is one of those, and breastfeeding is also there. But really, to be healthy, we need to look at food security. We need to look at on-time high school completion. We need to look at income. That's why I'm so pleased that I think the biggest public health achievement of this session has been the passage of the minimum wage, which is going to have a tremendous impact on health, particularly health among the lowest income populations in our state. So, I mean, that is a public health achievement of great significance. A sense of security. Business development. You know, if we have a sound economic system, we're going to be healthier. Home ownership and incarceration justice. We have disparities in incarceration. And so they were looking at the fact that in order to accomplish these, we needed to take a health in all policies approach. Health is not just the responsibility of the health department, certainly not the responsibility of just the medical care system. Health is really the responsibility of all of the agencies of state government, actually all components, all sectors of our society. And so that formed the basis of our Healthy Minnesota 2020 framework, and the framework that we're working at the health department and with our partners throughout the state. And it recognizes that those social determinants of health are really important. But as so, with that as background, part of what this report recognized is that not everyone, that third circle on the bottom of those themes, it was becoming really clear that not everybody was benefiting equally in our society, in various parts of the state or in various communities. And so that we needed to focus on that health equity piece in greater detail. And so that led to our desire to look more at advancing health equity. And then and at the same time, thanks to the legislature, which, you know, asked us to create a report on advancing health equity, it was a good synergistic, it was a good launching point for us to develop this report. So thank you for the impetus for charging us to do this report that we're going to be reporting on today. And this report came about, and I think you have a copy of the report, came about in a unique way, and it's actually just even creating the report has taught us a lot. For many of the reports that we make, we get the experts together, you write a report, and then you farm it out to the community to get input and get their feedback, and then redo the report. We took this a different approach. We went to the community first and said, tell us what you're seeing in terms of health equity, of disparities in your community, and we will capture those stories, and we will then create the report around what we're hearing. So we had 180 conversations with over 1,000 people throughout the state and heard lots of stories, had lots of input, and lots of people sending things in online. And then we, from all of that, we wrote the report and then put it back out to the community and say, did you hear your voice in this report? And if they said, no, we don't hear our voice in this report, we went back and said, how can we make sure that your voice is heard? And so there were lots of back and forth on that. And I think this, for us, that has taught us a lot about how we really need to look at creating the reports that we do in many areas. We really need to focus on the community that's most affected and then get their voice in those reports. And so from this report that we submitted to the legislature on February 1st of this year, certainly one of the key findings of the report is that health inequities persist in Minnesota and that they can't be explained purely by biogenetic factors alone, that there are many other factors that are responsible for those inequities, and that health is created through social, economic, and environmental factors within the communities. And it's as well as individual behavior and biology. We don't negate the fact that individual choice is important, but that choice in the context of the community that either supports or undermines healthy choices is really important. So it was really the social, economic, and environmental factors within a community that are the members of the population throughout the state really recognized. And it was in that it was really those social and environmental factors where people live, work, and play that were really important. And it highlighted the facts, some of the facts that I pointed out to you right at the beginning of my presentation, that poverty rates for children under the age of 18 are twice as high for Asian children, three times as high for Hispanic and Latino children, four times as high for American Indian children, and nearly five times as high for African American children. Poverty rates are a huge problem in populations of color and American Indians in our state, and that is going to be an issue that we have to address. And while 75% of the white population in Minnesota owns their own home, only 21% of African Americans own their own home. And I mean, that was important for us, that just even our own looking at what we were doing, recognizing that if we just target for our educational efforts homeowners, we are going to be disadvantaging some populations who don't own their own homes. So the report really pointed out that not all people in Minnesota have the same opportunity to be healthy. And health inequities are caused by social disadvantaging some groups through something that we identified in the report as structural racism, that policies that are in place that disadvantage populations, maybe inadvertently, but disadvantage them nonetheless. This is not about individual racism. It is about policies that disadvantage some populations. And certainly we looked at, like I said, we looked at our radon program where we were targeting, you know, people, homeowners, and recognized that disadvantaged populations of color who didn't own their own homes. So we have changed our procedures with that. We looked at the example of the Central Corridor Light Rail, which initially was set up to move people as quickly as possible from Minneapolis to St. Paul. And efficiency was a good goal to have, but it disadvantaged the people in the middle, particularly low-income and populations of color in the Midway area that didn't have the stops. Unfortunately, the community became exercised and got three extra stops. It was a form of institutional racism that was put together, inadvertently disadvantaged some populations. And so we've discovered, as we're looking at there, that there are these roots of health inequities present in many of our systems and in many of our policies, and that these inequities are unjust and are avoidable if we do the right kind of policy decisions. And it's really subtle because these policies, these disparities have been set up and they've been normalized, that we expect some of these disparities to exist. You know, why should we even expect that African American babies should die at two to three times the rate of white? Why should that even be considered to be a normal situation? That is, I think, when we start to think about it, there's no biogenetic reason for that to occur. It is really because of a whole lot of other things. So that is formed the basis of our report that was looking at these inequities, particularly the policy issues, the health and all policies approaches. And then we came up with a series of recommendations. And in your report on page 7, we have a list of those recommendations. And those recommendations are in a couple of categories. One is sort of recommendations in general, and then there are some recommendations particularly for the Minnesota Department of Health. But we're really saying that we really need to, as a state, we really need to advance health equity through a health and all policies approach. We need to recognize that health is the responsibility of everyone. It is certainly the responsibility of the policymakers. It's certainly the responsibility of program and department administrators like myself. It's the responsibility of community agencies, and it's responsibility in all of the sectors. And as I go around the state talking to business communities and talking to the faith community and talking to the education community, and as we start to show the data that says, you know, your policies actually down the road impact health, they start to say, all right, we want to partner with you in this. So we have a health and all policies approach. And later on this summer, I'll actually be working with my other cabinet members in our administration to really say, let's together work on health equity, advancing health equity. So with transportation and corrections and education and DEED and DNR, all have started to all do recognize that they play a role in health. We also need to continue to invest in the efforts that are currently working. There are lots of things that are working. And Melanie Peterson-Hickey will talk a little bit about our advancing health or our eliminating health disparities initiative that's been going on for the last 10 years. So we want to continue those programs. And we also need to provide some leadership. We need to keep health equity as a centerpiece of what we're doing. And so it needs statewide leadership. That's why I'm really appreciative of your being here to listen to what we're thinking and are talking about and putting forward, and so that you can take some leadership in this. We also have to strengthen those community relationships and partnerships. Health really is a community issue, and we're really working hard to have communities own health as an issue that they can address and empower them to help in the decision-making, get the communities at the table for the decision-making that needs to occur on the health policies. And so with that, we're strengthening a lot of coalitions, and also we're trying to advance collection of data, because we need a lot more data to support what we're doing and analyze what's working. So those are some general recommendations that we're doing. We're also certainly working within the department to redesign what we're doing. We're redesigning our grant-making activities to better reflect input from the communities. We do a lot of grant making, but a lot of times, you know, we focus on doing grants related to best practices that are put together nationally, but recognizing now that maybe those best practices are not the best practices in certain communities. So we're starting to gain more information about what's best practices in communities, what's the best practices on the reservations, and then to support those best practices through our grant-making activities. And we're certainly making health equity an issue throughout the department, so that it is not just the Center for Health Equity that's working on this or the executive office, but we're training staff throughout the agency in compliance monitoring and vital records and environmental health and food-borne illnesses and infectious disease and maternal and child. I mean, we all have to take this on as a central core issue. And we're certainly working with our partners in local public health, and I'll be leaving this after this meeting to go work with our state CHS advisory committee, who have really embraced the whole idea of health in all policies and health equity as an approach that we really need to make central. And so I'll be working with them over the next, an ongoing basis, but even today talking with them about this. And then we also said that we really needed to coordinate our efforts within the department. And that's why we've established the Center for Health Equity. And Melanie Peterson-Hickey is our interim director of our Center for Health Equity. And I'd like Melanie to come forward and join me here and explain what the Center for Health Equity is and what our hopes are and dreams for that. And then I'll come after that and give you some suggestions on where we're going and where you might be able to help us. Melanie.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Ellinger, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here to talk about the Advancing Health Equity Report. This is a really exciting opportunity for me. It's the first time, actually, that I presented at a committee like this.
And since this is your first time, let me just remind you, you need to say your name for the record, even though we've already said your name.
Okay. My name is Melanie Peterson-Hickey, and I'm the Acting Director for the Minnesota Department of Health Center for Health Equity. And I'm here today to talk to you about some of the ongoing activities of the Center for Health Equity and the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative. While I've been in the role of the Acting Director for just under a month, I've been with the Minnesota Department of Health for nearly 14 years as a research scientist in the Center for Health Statistics. One of the functions of the Minnesota Center for Health Statistics is to provide technical assistance and support to the Office of Minority Health and the Multicultural Office of Minority Multicultural Health and the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, and produce periodic reports on the health status of minorities, as we've used the term in the past, in Minnesota. So for many years, my colleagues and I wrote reports that documented the poor health status and significant health disparities experienced by some populations in the state. So I'm really pleased to be here to talk to you about the Center for Health Equity and Advancing Health Equity efforts, because I believe that due to the legislator's requirement for the Advancing Health Equity report, the process of completing the report and the activities that MDH has since implemented are creating the opportunity for us to collectively identify both the underlying factors that have contributed to creating this poor health status and health disparities, but also helping us to identify pathways that can finally have an impact on improving health and eliminating these disparities that exist that have been with us for so long. Also for creating the opportunity for all Minnesotans to have the opportunity to attain the highest possible level of health, as Commissioner Ellinger noted earlier. Now for an update on the Center for Health Equity. It's a newly formed group within the department with the mission of leading a department-wide initiative to bring a health equity analysis and intention to the efforts and partnerships of MDH. We'll be building the capacity of the center to provide technical assistance to advance health equity throughout the agency and with our state, local, and community partners. To create the Center for Health Equity, MDH brought together three existing units within the department to align agency efforts around the health equity agenda. These units include the Center for Health Statistics, the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, and the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative. Health Statistics collects and analyzes important data sets such as the BRFSS, Behavioral Risk Factors Surveillance Survey, the Minnesota Student Survey, birth and death records, and more. It collects and analyzes the data on population health and monitors Minnesota health disparities and population health outcomes. They do and will continue to monitor the state progress on health equity. The focus of the Office of Minority Multicultural Health will shift from a grants management effort to working more closely with racial and ethnic communities who experience the greatest health challenges in Minnesota. Staffing of the OMMH includes cultural liaison, cultural expertise, and identification of best practice functions for African-American and African-born, Hispanic, Latino, and Asian communities in Minnesota. MDH also has an American Indian health director performing these functions for the American Indian tribes and communities in Minnesota. The cultural liaisons in OMMH will be working with MDH program staff to strengthen community relationships across the entire agency, while also working with the communities themselves to identify health needs and opportunities for health improvements. The EHDI grant program will continue to be a critical program. It is an example of what was meant, as Commissioner Ellinger stated, in Recommendation 2 in the report, continuing investments and efforts that are currently working to advance health equity. The EHDI staff will include a dedicated grant manager and management financial analyst. The AHE report has also provided several bigger opportunities for MDH to move the AHE agenda, advancing health equity agenda, in other areas. Including some of the following. In the next year, we'll be partnering with EHDI grantees to look back at this important grant program, to review what we've learned about the priority health areas that are currently part of the EHDI, the populations that are served, the significant impact that the grants have had on local communities, identify areas that could be strengthened, and how to measure and report on the impact of this grant program. We'll use this process to inform the development of the next RFP and plan to bring recommendations for shifting, strengthening, or increasing emphasis of the grant program to the legislature in 2015. An example of a small change that we've been able to make as a result of our involvement with the Advancing Health Equity process is that we have made arrangements to financially support the grantees' efforts to participate in this review and RFP redesign. Along the same line, we've been hearing from tribal grantees that strategies to improve health and eliminate disparities in majority communities have not been as successful in American Indian communities. The report and the initiative have created the opportunity to work with tribal communities to get important input and feedback for two other grant programs, the Tobacco-Free Communities and SHIP grants. With this input, we've been able to identify how these grant programs can be more culturally responsive and effective for tribal communities in Minnesota. We plan to complete this planning process with tribes by midsummer and incorporate recommendations from tribes into the new grants that are beginning in November 2014. Across the agency, we're working to question our assumptions and examine our processes, policies, and systems across the board. When it appears we may not achieve the outcome we intended, we have begun to identify ways to interrupt the process or work and consider ways that we can make adjustments. Staff have been asking themselves, their program staff, a set of inquiry sessions to identify the structural inequities that might exist and consider how effective we are in reaching communities experiencing the greatest disparities. This means we're looking at how we write our RFPs, how we're selecting the grantees for these programs, who's doing the selection, and what approaches will have the greatest impact for those with the greatest need. And we're taking action where we can. A recent example, and there are many, the RFP for our grant program focusing on sex trafficking yielded no applicants prepared to focus on Minnesota tribal communities. The staff identified that this would be an unacceptable outcome of the process because data indicates that American Indian communities in Minnesota experience the greatest impact from sex trafficking in Minnesota. Due to the Advancing Health Equity Initiative, the staff was able to stop the process and work with a number of tribes to identify strategies that would address these groups. Another example is that we heard from communities that by using the term evidence-based practices in our preconception grant RFP, we were not as responsive to their needs to promote a practice-based evidence approach that was based in the culture and values of their communities. We spent a little bit more time with the process. We extended the deadline to adjust to the process so that we could be more connected to the priorities of this community. We've also been working at re-examining our processes for identifying the role and membership of MDH advisory committees and made changes in the way that we recruit members. There are lots of large and small examples of what's happening as a result of this report, including just this enormous energy and enthusiasm internally throughout the state and even across the country, as we've had several inquiries from other states about the report and about the process that we undertook to get there. While we did not include legislative proposals in this session, it has been gratifying to test our capacity to respond to all of the opportunities that have been presented, but also a challenge with a limited capacity to respond. We recognize that we are only beginning this process and deeper reflection, and that we have a lot to learn as we move forward.
Commissioner? Thank you, Melanie.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hickey. And I just want to say, you mentioned that this is your first testimony, and that was excellent, and I hope that we'll be seeing you a lot more in this committee.
Thank you.
Dr. Ellinger.
We're really pleased to have Melanie leading this effort and helping us form this new way. And as she mentioned, it is transforming how we do business within the department. There is a new conversation going on within the department about how we really address the central challenge of advancing health equity. And as we come into advance into the 21st century, this is the new public health. You know, we've got approaches to deal with infectious diseases and acute diseases, but the things that are really going to make us healthy will require a different approach, really a more community-oriented approach, a much more respectful approach with community input and involvement in some of the processes. So it's changing how we're doing public health in the 21st century. And as Melanie pointed out, we're getting lots of positive feedback throughout the state. People are coming to thank you, first of all, for identifying structural racism as an issue. They acknowledge, a lot of communities have acknowledged that that has been there, has not been addressed as forthrightly as we have in this report. And it has allowed them to then challenge us in a respectful way in ways that they've never done before. Because they know now, or I hope they're learning, that they have a partner with us so that they can challenge us and they can say, you're not doing things correctly, not because they want to criticize us, but because they want us to do a better job and they want us as partners. So I think that is changing. We're also getting a sense, as I go throughout the state, that the narrative is changing about what creates health is starting to change, not just among medical care, but also among community members, that we really do need to focus on all of the policies and all of the programs and all of the issues that really impact health. And it's also changing. We're getting, as Melanie said, lots of comments and questions from around the country as people are seeing our process. Even the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, is looking to us using our model as a way to advance health equity. And even though This was the unsession, and we were not very aggressive in our approaches under the direction of my boss. We wanted to keep things controlled. But it's amazing how the community has come forward with a lot of policies and bills related to advancing health equity that have been really generated by this report. Didn't come from us, but came from the community because they felt empowered. Certainly, the, a task force on foreign trained physicians, safe harbor as for the sexual trafficking and making that much more culturally specific services. A bill on race, ethnicity, and language that we're going to implement a plan for getting better data for analyzing the impact of disparities and how different programs affect those disparities. We've added risk adjustment methodology for potential harm and unintended consequences for patient populations who experience health disparities using the APCD, All Payer Claims Database, came forward as one of these initiatives from outside the department. The spoken language interpreters that you had some discussion with, we're now going to be doing a lot of work to make sure that spoken language interpreters get more attention and get better training and more transparent about what qualifications are. And even our Healthy Homes grant, we've got funding to support and implement a healthy homes and healthy housing activities, working with community agencies and nonprofit agencies. So a lot of these things are already bubbling forward. So I'm anticipating, as we are setting the stage for the 2015 session, that more and more of those issues are going to be coming forward, because those are the kinds of things that we're going to need to do as a state. So the next steps in this process, like I said, this is the first step in setting the stage for next year, but this is a process that will be never ending, and so we need your help and we need your ideas, and we'll be coming up with the legislative proposals that I hope we can move forward in the next session. As I said, I'm convening a cabinet level discussion on health equity. We're doing all of the things that Melanie had to say, in terms of our grant making, and we'll also be looking at how we can do health impact assessments in a variety of areas on things that particularly affect populations of color and American Indians. But we always have to have an ask, on most of our things. And I do have an ask for you, actually a couple of asks. I know this, you're going to be getting out of here soon, and many of you are running for re-election, and you'll be door knocking. And so I just ask, as you go knocking on doors, ask people, what creates health? What in your community could actually help you be healthier in your community? What are the conditions that you find necessary, as in your conversations, for you and your family to be healthy? What do your neighbors need to prosper and to really improve the quality of life? Ask those questions and ask them, what policy changes do you see that need to be made to really advance health equity? And ask them how they want to get involved in some of those policy decisions. How do they want to get involved in creating a healthier society? That's sort of the inquiry we need. And lastly, on the flip side of this page is a list of questions that you as policymakers, I hope, would consider as you think about policies in this venue and other venues. If you're looking at existing policies, what are the outcomes, who benefits, and who's left out? We always have to look at who's left out, because we often ignore that. And in new policies, what outcomes do we want, and who should be targeted to benefit? And in all the processes, who's at the table? Who's at the decision-making table? We certainly recognize that if you're not at the decision-making table, your needs are often left out, and we have systematically left out many populations, particularly populations of color. Who has the power at the table? Who helps to make the decisions? What are the assumptions? What are the assumptions that underlie some of the decisions that we make? So I want you to, this list of sort of questions, I would hope that you would consider those as you move forward in your careers as policymakers and in your careers as citizens that we all play. We need to ask those questions and continually ask for those. So thank you for your time and attention today. Thank you for encouraging us to put this report together. We look forward to partnering with you and all legislators and the governor's office and people throughout the state in really advancing health equity. So if I'm going to be a successful health commissioner, if we can advance health equity, that will make my job a success, and that is the goal that I'm shooting for. So I'm open to questions, and we have other staff here to answer some of the questions that you might have.
Well, thank you very much. And I haven't seen any hands go up yet, but wow. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. Dr. Ellinger and Ms. Hickey, first of all, let me just say that I, despite my fatigue, this is very exciting stuff. And I'm so grateful that you came this morning to present to us, and I know that you had to rearrange schedules on the fly and things like that to do it, but this is really very exciting, and I can see that the members feel like that too. Definitely worth getting up for. And let's hear some of the questions. Let's see, I don't know what we're in line. Representative Moran.
Okay. Good morning, and thank you so much for being here today and to present on your findings. I just only wish there was more legislators around this table, because really your findings really dictate how we as policymakers can create policies that can really begin to reduce the disparities and the inequities that we are finding in our states, and recognizing that it's not just about the personal responsibility, but it is also about the policies that we've been creating. And although, you know, let me just say that we know sometimes that's not intentional. It is not intentional, but that is sometimes the outcome and the impact of the decisions that we make around the table. So thank you so much for changing your approach to how you do your work, and realizing that there are major players missed from the table. And a lot of times that is people from communities of color who are not at the decision-making tables to bring a perspective around how around what is needed to make their lives better. And I think that is really a critical part of what is needed to create the different outcomes that we are seeing in communities of color. So I was listening to you making your statement, and I won't talk so much about it now. I'm going to save that for another time, like in a session when there's more representatives around to hear my statement around the need for a racial equity impact statement. And it's kind of like I'm hearing some of that language in your report of what you want, even through these questions that you are saying that we need to use as legislators when we're making our decisions. And I think this is a good start for us to do our job, because we want to really, I believe, that what we want to do here as legislators is to create a more fair and just society where all of us are benefiting. I really believe that is why we come to this place, to create a strong Minnesota, and that's only done when we all prosper. So, and we have really, you named a lot of things that we have done this session, from looking at the home bill to looking at translators and to looking at self-trafficking. Those are some of the things that we are beginning to look to say, you know, how can we create policies that are intentionally going to help communities of color through a policy procedure way. So I just thank you for that. Data collection, I think, you know, I introduced a bill that, you know, we really got to start collecting data in a more, in a way that really capture what we want. One of the biggest things that I saw when I first came here was, like, we look at communities and we say, well, we have blacks. And blacks can mean from African Americans to Somalis to Nigerians to a bunch of groups. And we do that in all the other areas, from Asians to Latinos. And we're different, you know. And the needs on our needs and how we see the world and how we are engaged in our communities and our families are different. And until we can capture that in our data collection, it makes it really impossible to create policies and best practices for all when we are clumping people together in that type of way. So my hope is that we can look more at my data bill maybe this summer and bring it back next session to really begin to help inform the way we do our work, not only here but in different departments. I think until we tap into not only the health department, but the education and the criminal justice system, I mean, all the different systems, and begin to do as you are doing, you know, and begin to look at how do we do our work in a different way. What is that different approach that is different but needed, that become a common practice in how we do our work and how the departments look at how to be creating a more informed policy practices within their department. So you talked about a cultural expertise, and I'm kind of like wondering, what is a cultural expertise? That is one question that I have. If you can address that question, what do you see as a person who has a cultural expertise?
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Chair and members of the committee, in response to that question, I think that right now we have staff that have been working at MDH for a number of years, and they've been very extensively involved in working in communities of color. They're also from those communities of color, and so they have the experience and the skills to be able to communicate and connect and understand, you know, what the particular needs are from communities that might differ from one group to another. And so I just think that they have some exceptional skills in being able to connect to the communities and connect communities with health department staff and health department efforts.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I forgot to recognize you. So, Madam Chair, let me do this properly, right? and to the testifier, so it was the cultural expertise and the cultural liaison. Why is the cultural liaison, in your opinion, important?
Ms. Hickey.
Chair and members of the committee, I think in response to that question, it's because we have a limited number of staff at the department that are from those cultural communities, and so I think that it's a really critical role for us to have in the Office of Minority Health. Again, making connections, being able to communicate, being able to connect with the leadership, being able to build leadership in those communities. To, you know, even have conversations, you know, build the skills at the community level to be able to come to the state, come to the legislature to express their needs and issues, and also being able to work with MDH staff in order to build capacity within the department to reach out and engage community in our process.
Let me expand on that a little bit.
Dr. Ellinger.
We've had a grant program, the Eliminating Health Disparities Grant Program, and as successful as that grant program has been, it has not really changed overall changed the disparities that we have. They've been on some great things in local communities, but we've recognized that just grants by themselves are not going to do that. We're going to need to really empower the communities and really change our relationship with communities of color and American Indians, and so this liaison. We're no longer going to have that person be the grant manager. We're going to have a separate grant activities to make sure the grants do really well. But the liaison with the communities is actually going to really enhance the relationship that we have with communities of color and American Indians, and also empower those communities to be really much more they can advocate for themselves. They can put themselves in places, find opportunities to be there so they can be at the table. It is helping to change our relationship with communities throughout the state.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, because I think, you know, since I've been here, that has been one of my phrases that I use so often, is that, you know, one of my jobs here of many is to connect community with the capital and the capital with the community. I think that's really important, that we see ourselves as being a part of the decision making process, and a lot of times that is just a part of showing up and sharing your experience and sharing your expertise and helping to us here expand our, you know, our worldview. And how we see the world that may not always be in line with how communities of color see the world. So having that cultural liaison person, that cultural expertise here representing the voices of the community is important. But, you know, we have a huge advocates out there who are working towards that end to also bring in those perspectives from the community that is so necessary as we begin to work towards reducing the disparities. But what was so interesting to me is that to help us better understand, a health disparity is not just about the physical health. It's not just about the mental health. It is about having great schools. It is about having safe communities. It is so much beyond. It's about good food, healthy food, eating properly, and having those resources in our community. It is so much beyond. It's the social-emotional development of communities and individuals. It is so much beyond. We look at health. It is not just about the physical health of the body, but all those different factors that come into place that helps create, you know, strong families, strong kids, strong communities, and even a stronger state. So thank you for being here, and hopefully that, you know, your work, you can continue your work, and this will expand to other departments, and you can continue to have those strong partnerships and help to influence your work that will help influence their work that at the end of the day will create better outcomes for communities of color. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. And as people probably know, she sits next to me on the floor, and I've learned a tremendous amount from her over these last 2 years. It's been a wonderful experience. Representative Albright.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think we have a bit of a caucus disparity here this morning, and so based upon that, I'm sure you'll proportion my time accordingly. Dr. Ellinger, good morning. I'd like to draw your attention first to page 23 of your report. I appreciate the fact that you provided pictures and graphs in your report, but I was very curious about this graph. Relevant to two statements that were made on the preceding page, the first to say health outcomes are primarily the result of systemic differences in socially determined conditions and processes. And in the last paragraph, it says conditions that create the opportunity for everyone to be healthy. And to my first question, Doctor, I wondered if you would respond to the graph. And I'll draw your attention to the epicenter of longevity, which would appear to be in the Richfield-Bloomington area. And I'll just ask you first to respond in terms of what inferences we might derive from this graph.
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you. This graph has been put together by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and is used by Blue Cross and Blue Shield from multiple data sources that points out that where you live actually makes a difference in your health. And it points out that over the course of 3 miles, you can have a difference in overall life expectancy of 13 years. And that it reflects the conditions really within the community that the kind of housing that you have, the kind of job opportunities you have, the kind of educational level that you have, kind of environment you have, will make a difference in your health and longevity. So that place matters, and what happens with place is a lot dealt with on many of the environmental and policy issues that reflect and have helped to shape the development of those communities along that I-94 corridor.
Yeah, and before I go back to you, Representative Albright, this is 94.
Yes.
Yeah, so Richfield is not on that map,
yeah,
I don't think.
This is Interstate 94.
Representative Albright.
Yes. Dr. Ellinger, given that, I'm just wondering if, you know, given the transient nature of our population, I'm wondering if that was considered or might be considered in light of the age disparities just out 2 miles. what timeline was this taken into consideration over?
Dr. Ellinger?
And Madam Chair and Representative Albright, this is a cross-sectional look at life expectancies with, you know, at one point in time. These, although individuals may be transient, the communities have remained, the socioeconomic characteristics of the communities along that corridor have remained fairly constant over the years. So it's really looking at, overall what that community, the population level is of health is in that community along the interstate.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I would add to that just by the notion that people do assimilate with others of like character, of like outlook on life, and what have you. And so that seems to make some sense given that. I will draw your attention also to the chart, the table on page 79. And Madam Chair, I'm wondering if Dr. Ellinger would be willing to answer a question with regard to, I note as the paragraph just above the chart responds that there is a disparity within the American Indian population. I'm wondering if Dr. Ellinger would first answer a question with regard to the total population of the American Indian population in the state of Minnesota.
Sure, and before we go to him for that, Representative Albright, I just want to let members know that it is our intention to finish by 10, and because there are other things going on, and particularly Dr. Ellinger has to be elsewhere. So just with that caveat, Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, my understanding in terms of total population, and I will defer to Ms. Peterson Hickey, since she's from our Center for Health Statistics, but I believe our American Indian population is about 2% of our of the overall state's population.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one final question then. As you look at the graph going from left to right, and it's noted there is a great disparity in terms of the mortality as you progress through the age bands, and then it just seems to level off along with the white population. And I'm just wondering if Dr. Ellinger, you have any prognosis, if you will, or conclusions to draw from the 65 plus age band.
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, could you be a little more specific on the question, if you could?
And I'll infer to in your testimony previously, you spoke to a lifestyle, community habits, community community living, support mechanisms, that type of thing. I'm wondering if those are an indicator that levels it off for that population, indicative of what the white population would be also.
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, in comparing the white with the black or African American, their life expectancy after the age of 65, as I mentioned, is actually pretty much the same. Once you reach 65, life expectancy is about the same, about 20 years. For whites, about 17 of those years, 16 of those years are healthy life, and 4 years are unhealthy. Almost the opposite perspective is unhealthy life for African Americans is about 15, 16 years, and healthy life is about 4 or 5 years. So that reflects a whole variety of things. We're keeping people alive, and so the You know, the mortality rates are about the same, relatively the same, but what they're experiencing in terms of the quality of their life is markedly different. And a lot of those have to do with the situations that have led up to that point in time in terms of their educational level, their income level, and a variety of other social and economic factors.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a very helpful insight, because I think that speaks to reading between the numbers and just really understanding what's important in those later years in terms of the medical delivery for the silver tsunami that's coming ashore, and how we have to address that going forward. So thank you, Madam Chair.
I think that's an important point, the fact that as we age, you know, they say, well, you know, that's going to increase costs, but we can decrease costs if we can keep people healthy in those last years. And there are a lot of prevention things that we could do. It's not just about the young folks, it's actually about the older folks. You know, if we can get the elderly folks to be more physically active, eat right, reduce their alcohol use, reduce tobacco use, a lot of those things will decrease the number of unhealthy years and will save us huge costs in the future.
Yeah, and Dr. Ellinger, as I'm looking at this chart or this table that Representative Albright has flagged on page 79, this must be the average for each year within that age group, because otherwise, 65 plus, your mortality rate has to be 100%, I assume, right? So, but we don't need to go there, but, you know, I just...
That's why I'm glad that Melanie,
yeah,
a statistician, she can answer all of those,
right,
health statistics.
Okay, let's see. I think Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really excited about this. In the last few weeks, I started some conversations to build toward some work for next session, and it has to do starting with early childhood nutrition. Preschool infant nutrition, and that has already started to grow arms into agriculture and some other areas of education in the secondary schools. So it, you know, like I said, it's growing arms, and I'm just my question is, who should I talk to in your department to develop this a little bit more?
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, thank you for that comment, because, you know, we're really working really a lot on prenatal to three, mm-hmm, particularly because I think that if we're going to get third grade reading, we need stable housing, we need, you know, fewer low birth weight babies, we need good health care, we need good nutrition, we need good, you know, parenting activities. It's not just about, you know, getting people into high quality daycare. That's one piece of a multitudinal, mm-hmm, things. It is a health and all policies approach, and the earlier you start, the better it is. Jean Ayers, who is the commissioner of our health promotion unit, our health improvement unit, is my assistant commissioner in that area, is leading some of our efforts with the Children's Cabinet and the prenatal to three efforts. So Commissioner Ayers would be the one to chat with.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and my thoughts carry this into corrections, and, you know, people gather around food, mm-hmm, and if we can start with some of that focus, and originally the thought too was, as you said, getting reading to a good level at an appropriate age. We've done some things to increase the funding for nut lunches at schools, for school lunches and school food programs, particularly so that kids can have healthier food, fresh food, more produce, especially vegetables. If you don't start that in infancy, the kids don't develop the taste for it. And so that, I mean, that for me is a metaphor for a lot of other things you're talking about. You start early so that they can develop the appropriate tastes for that healthy lifestyle as early as possible, and I think that working with parents, prenatal, as well as early childhood, is also kind of a ripe time for them to be maybe taking some different directions in their own lives. And so I really appreciate that, and Ms. Ayers, we will talk. Thank you.
Dr. Ellinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, add a couple of comments to that. Our statewide health improvement program, SHIP, thanks to the funding from the legislature, is actually dealing with a lot of those issues in counties, every county throughout the state, or almost every county throughout the state. And also this fall, we are going to be coming forward with a food charter that has, again, been a work in progress to really look at food security and all of the nutrition issues at all ages, which I think we will certainly let you know when we release that food charter in October.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you very much, and for being patient with us on a day when we're all dedicated to do this work because we showed up at 2 hours of sleep. And but I have to say, I want you to know that your work has already had an impact. We were presented with an issue of the Department of Human Services rebidding all of its managed care contracts for people on MA in Minnesota Care. And they had a long list of criteria. And we added in committee that they should look at how the health plans were serving people with racial and cultural and language issues. Now, we had to winnow that long list because the Senate hadn't considered it into a very tight, tight little few lines, but we kept that in there. And so that even though we hadn't had a hearing, we were listening and we are trying to figure out how to inform our decision making. The other thing I'd like to say to Ms. Peterson-Heckey is I think you can be a leader not only on how we to address disparities, but in developing a different decision making style. And I've always been an advocate for data-driven decision-making, but I hear you leading on the next frontier, which to me is going to make us really more effective, which is community-informed data. And if we don't combine those two, I don't think we're going to get to where we need to be. And my best example of that is in my community, we have an area that I would call transit-advantaged. And if you just look at the data, they have buses every 5 minutes during rush hour, every 10 minutes through the day. It looks like this is a place that if somebody was transit dependent, it would be wonderful to live. Instead, if you're on the southern end of my district, because of my meetings with the community, I know that you have a source of daily chronic stress because the buses fill up before they get to you. And so every day you start your day out wondering how many buses are going to pass you by before you get on and how late will you be for work. And with the kind of winter that we had this year with those bitter, bitter colds, it was particularly, you know, agonizing to be out there and dangerous to be out there in the cold. You would never know that by looking at the bus schedules, by looking at the charts. You would pay attention to other parts of my district where the buses are less frequent, where you sometimes have to walk farther to get to a bus, maybe a half a mile. And you'd say, that's where we need to pay attention to. And yet the people who live in that public high-rise and the low and moderate income people in those neighborhoods are being disadvantaged because the buses are filling up even before they even get to the city with the suburban transit users. And so I think we need to learn to blend both in a way that we haven't. And this is really exciting work that you're doing on all fronts. But I would really encourage you to continue to look at that as a model and figure out how you can contribute that to the profession of using information and decision making.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Loeffler. That actually kind of gives me chills, that thing you just mentioned. And, you know, who would have ever thought about it? So thank you for bringing that forward. And also, thank you for making sure that language got in that you were discussing because, in our negotiations, that was something that we needed to make sure happened, and Representative Loeffler made that happen.
We had a willing audience because people were aware.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Representative Huntley?
Well, Madam Chair, and just a couple of statements here. First of all, the bad news for you folks, I grew up on the western side of St. Paul there, and I see if I maintain the average, I got another 7 years to. But I just want to talk a little bit about the bill that we passed this morning, about 2:30, I think. I don't know what time it was, but And in that bill, there'll be about another $2 million for sex trafficking, about $1 million for housing, and $1 million for the development of a system to treat with these people. And in my area of the state, this is a particular issue, and it's much worse with the Indian tribes than it is for the rest of our society. And it's a huge issue, and it's something we have to deal with. And I will say, I think we were the first state that decided in 2011 that, and these aren't young women, they're girls, that they were victims, not criminals. And that was a huge change in attitude. And so I think we're in the lead at that. And then last night, just for Ms. Hickey, good news and bad news, we found an extra $250,000 for the health equity studies. And it's very, I really like what we did, because we had other money in there, and we have some things that we want done, but we're giving your department a lot of flexibility as to who gets the grants and how you distribute them and how much for each topic. But this, and given your report, was which got a lot of attention when it came out in April, I believe, this is a huge thing, but we're giving you the flexibility to decide how that money is used. But with that flexibility, then you're responsible for the results.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. And I think Representative Huntley, when he's talking about a bill we passed, I think you mean the conference report that must have passed out of the budget committee last night. You don't mean the bonding bill.
The conference committee report.
Yes.
Last night.
Right. So the rest of us haven't really seen it yet.
It's all kind of blurred together.
Absolutely. Well, we're looking forward to seeing that one today, I assume. So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be quick. And thank you, Dr. and Ms. Hickey, for just really a tremendous presentation. I'm struck by your new way of thinking, and I just want to ask a couple of questions related to that. You talked about the value of bringing together communities to embrace these sorts of ideas, and I happened to attend a meeting in St. Peter last summer, and maybe funded by the Department of Health, I don't know, but it was really the concept of what makes for a healthy community. And I watched my neighbors talk about it's a matter of a community coming together to embrace health for all and sharing a common responsibility towards that. And in many ways, what I saw last summer is similar to what I'm hearing your emphasis. So my question is, how can you bring together resources to support, whether it be St. Peter or other communities, or communities within communities, to help them actually implement that concept of a community responsibility towards a healthy community?
Dr. Ellinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we have been really encouraging those conversations throughout the state, and we're hearing wonderful stories. I mean, and a lot of this is happening through our statewide health improvement program, or our SHIP program, and we're hearing stories about farmers who are coming together and up front and saying, I'm being asked to talk about agriculture and the impact my farming is having on your community. I've never had this opportunity before, and they're really embracing this as a way to empower them. So we're really encouraging this through all of our community leadership teams, our community engagement activities, through our statewide health improvement program. Also, as part of our efforts through the Center of Health Equity, we're really trying to focus on our community engagement across the department so that we have a consistent and a more standardized way of engaging communities and encouraging community development. So we'll be doing a lot of work on that throughout the state, and community engagement is going to be one of the core pieces of our SHIP program and many of the other activities that we do.
And then, you know, another, Madam Chair and testifiers, another thought I had.
And many of the other activities that we do.
And then, you know, another, Madam Chair and testifiers, another thought I have is, you know, this is a different approach. And sometimes in the legislature, when we talk about underrepresented groups, some of our colleagues aren't as comfortable with focus on that. We know that, for instance, affirmative action is not always a popular concept, and there's pushback, is what I'm suggesting. Have you experienced any pushback on this new approach, and or are you anticipating pushback? It's more of a political pushback, and if so, what's your thinking along those lines?
Dr. Ellinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I've not experienced much pushback. I think there's a general consensus, and I believe it's a nonpartisan consensus that our population is changing, and that unless we address the issues of all population, we're not going to be a healthy state. We're getting a recognition throughout the country, and certainly in some of the rural communities where populations of color and immigrants are becoming an increasingly important part of their community, they recognize that they have to embrace these populations and engage with them to create a healthy community, or the town or the county or the community is not going to do well. I think there really is a sense that we need to do something different. We need to approach things differently because the stressors are too great. I'm sure there will be change is always difficult. We certainly, even within the department, changing the way we talk and interact raised some questions. It wasn't pushback. It was like, how is this going to work, and is this really going to be effective, and how is it going to be perceived? And the more we change our conversation, the more we're getting buy-in from this. And certainly, I think as we work to have communities of color and American Indians be more empowered, they can also be at the table and have the conversations and advocate for themselves in ways that, you know, really it's not, I don't have to do that, but they can do it themselves. And so I think there we're going to see some change, and I'm sure there will be bumps along the road, but I'm really optimistic that Minnesota has a history of doing things right. And I think now, as we call attention to things that have to change and processes that have to change, I think we're up to the challenge, regardless of what side of the aisle you're from.
Thank you, Dr. Ellinger. I'm going to give Representative Dean a chance as well, because he, many people here know he's not on the committee, but he's interested enough in the topic to get up this morning and be here as well. I know he's multitasking too, but Representative Dean.
Thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair. And Dr. Ellinger, I've got a couple statements, and I'm going to follow that with a question that I think is really critical. You know, I think it's fantastic that you've called out structural racism in this document. I think it's something that is really hard for a lot of people to wrap their hands around. And until we start making this a key component of conversation, I think we're always going to struggle on that notion of what is structural racism. So I just want to commend you on that. And as part of that, I think that one of the things when we look at equity and disparities and all these types of things, that oftentimes the way in which we measure and those systems that we set up to measure are, of course, from that normalized white point of view. And so inherently it has a lens that we're looking through. And, you know, we see that in education all the time. You know, the tests are set up to measure certain things that are based on what I would call a white Anglo-European point of view of what is success. And in our society, of course, we live in a meritocracy society that really considers the success of people where they are at that point and not really where they begin as far as measuring what is that success. And I think that's something that's really critical that we always need to take into account, is where is it that we begin. And I love the fact that you're starting to collect a lot of data, which I think many communities of color have known for many years, and the data just hasn't been there. And so the data actually, I think, will help to move us forward. So with all that said, I think the task critically for part of this is changing a worldview of so many people. And I've seen that you've had some things, you know, some in the plan in this and in listening to your testimony. How much of an effort or how much of a focus do you see the role in moving forward with this report and, you know, addressing a lot of the disparities that exist is outside of the actual work of doing that and really plays a part in sort of changing a worldview and shaping the way that so many of us have thought so many years that this is what normal is, that maybe it's not.
Dr. Ellinger?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, thank you for those comments. And you are right on in terms of structural racism is an unintentional thing, and it's unintentional because it's based on what the premise that, you know, what the majority community has thought was good. When we focus it on cost and efficiency, those are good values. You know, we want things to be, you know, cheap, you know, relatively cheap and effective. But when, if that's the only measure, you then disadvantage a whole lot of other communities. And so we're saying you have to look at more indicators. And it's based on, you look at those other indicators based on the worldview. And actually, we have actually purposely put in our Healthy Minnesota 2020 plan a whole effort on changing the narrative. We are working on changing the narrative about what creates health. So in every presentation, as you saw, as I started out, what creates health? It's not, and the common narrative, it's about individual choices and medical care. And so I always say that it is really more about the policies and the systems and the environment that we create and the socioeconomic conditions. So we have to continually go. And it's so hard, that narrative keeps going back to individual choice and medical care. And we have to keep saying back. And so we're working as a department and with partners throughout the state in our Healthy Minnesota partnership of how do we change that narrative. What is it that we need to do to change that narrative? Because it is when you have a different worldview that we're going to be able to make the changes that really are necessary. And you're a key component of that. You helped change that worldview by the policies, the policy discussions that you have and the policies that you put in place. That helps change the narrative. As Representative Huntley said, we're changing the narrative about sex trafficking and its unacceptability and redefining that it's not, you know, you're not a criminal, you're a victim. That is helping to change the narrative about what creates health. So that's why having this opportunity to present before you and answer your questions and hear your comments has been just really beneficial to me and the department.
Well, thank you both so very much. That's a great comment to end on. And I look forward to hearing a lot more about this issue in the next session, perhaps even in the interim. This certainly won't be the last time we're discussing these issues. And thank you so very much for your good work and for raising all of our awareness and giving us a lot more to think about. And with that, members, thank you all for your attendance. Thank you to the audience for your attendance as well at this very early hour, and we are adjourned.